Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I've got Mr. Locke with me today. Hello, Lockie.
Hi, how you doing?
People should know by now, right? When they hear that you're here with me, what's coming at them?
You got to know that the First World War or some element of it is not too far away, haven't you? No different this time. We've got some scheming and intriguing to talk about, hopefully, because Ronan McGreevy is with us, and he's a man who's written prolifically on Ireland in the First World War, including the Easter Rising. He's on the staff at the Irish Times, and he's with us to talk about his latest book, The Great Hatred, which examines the assassination of your friend and mine, Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson. Ronan, how are you?
Great, Zach. Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Brilliant. There was an element of sarcasm there about Henry Wilson being our friend. We like Haig. Wilson. I love Kitchener. So I have my issues with Mr. Wilson or Sir Wilson. But we're here today because you can't ignore him. Even if you don't like him very much, you can't ignore him, can you, Lockie?
No, not really. Right from 1914 to 1918, he's part of the story, and even before the Great War gets going. So I've been looking forward to this for a little while, yeah, actually.
Definitely.
Okay, Ronan, let's get going then. Sure. For those who don't know, for the uninitiated on this man, Wilson, Anglo-Irish, British Army officer, Ulsterman, wasn't he? I mean, can you tell us a bit about him?
Well, he was certainly Anglo-Irish, Alex. He was from Banlalee, County Longford, which is, ironically enough, one of the heartlands of Irish nationalism. It's in the south, which is interesting. He identified as an Ulster man because his family had been in Ulster since the Williamite Wars of the 1690. But actually, he wasn't actually temporarily from Ulster. He was from the south, which I think explains his reaction to the Anglo-Irish Treaty. He felt that Southern Unionists were being, like himself, were being abandoned. He had a very typically Anglo-Irish background. He went to Marlborough College, and he then failed every exam. He went to several times for the army, got in the back door through the militias and through the Royal Irish Regiment, and rose up by dint of both ability and by intrigue and by his ability to garner good friendships to become the chief of the Imperial General Staff in February 1918, which was the professional head of the British Army.
He's a bit of a Marmite character, isn't he? You mentioned intrigue. He is the best bitch in the British Army for me in the higher ranks, in terms of the intrigue and the bitchiness. Some of his quips are hilarious, but he's prolific, I think it's important to say, more as an army administrator than as a fighting general, isn't he?
Yes.
I love Marmite, I don't love Wilson. So tell us, because I am completely coloured by this, tell us what we can credit him with up to the end of the First World War.
Well, we can credit him with the preparations that the British Expeditionary Force had for the First World War. When he was director of military operations, it was he who drew up, it's probably his greatest single achievement. He was he who drew up the sort of logistical plans for six divisions of the British Army, which was a small force at the time in comparison with the French and German armies, but still it had a very good effect on the morale of the French nation to deploy on the left of the French army in the coming conflict against Germany. the British Expeditionary Force was able to deploy within 3 weeks of war being declared. It all went really, really smoothly. He had mapped out a plan for the Royal Navy and the French Railway Service to take the British Expeditionary Force to be deployed on the left flank of the French army. He had spent many years warning about the threat that Germany posed, and he was of course somebody who believed in conscription long before it was popular or implemented in the UK. So I think I think even his most ardent detractors would give him credit for his farsightedness when he came to showing how the British Army would be deployed once a European war broke out.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that, wouldn't you, Lockie? And I think it's important to say as well, as far as relations with the French go, he is the ultimate Francophile, isn't he?
Yes, he was the ultimate Francophile. He was he was educated at home in County Longford by French governesses who and he became a lifelong Francophile in a very monoglot British army, it's fair to say. He had a friendship that extended before the war with Ferdinand Foch, who would go on to become the Allied Supreme Commander in 1918, and the pair worked very well together. So chiefly Wilson's role during the war was as a liaison between the French and British forces. And as we know, that was kind of haphazard and ad hoc and all the rest of that until I think the German spring offensive of 1918 concentrated the minds of the Allies as to how close they came to defeat. So after that, obviously, you have the joint Allied command, and you have the war won essentially in 1918 at a time when most commentators believe that it would take until 1919 for the weight of American forces to bear on the German positions.
So, I mean, the kind of the coalition element then is clearly a strength of his. And I guess you could say it's a sharp appointment then in 1918, having him working with Foch, Supreme Commander. When we get to the end of the war, where does he go next? You know, we have the victorious Allies. The coalition doesn't need to be held together anymore. So what's next for Wilson after that?
Well, he's still his problems don't end on Armistice Day. I mean, Armistice creates a new set of problems for him. You have the largest army that Britain has ever assembled in any field. 7 million men have to be demobbed. And then you have all the problems, the post-war problems. We were inclined to think of the sort of height of the British Empire being the 19th century. But actually, British Empire was never as big as it was after the First World War, because you also had mandates in the Middle East, and you had huge problems in Egypt and Iraq, or Mesopotamia as it was then. You talk about Ireland at that stage being a problem as well, but like there was problems across the empire, and there was also problems in India as well. There was a separatist separatism was growing there, especially after the Amritsar massacre. So you had all that. Then you had the deployment of British troops in Russia as part of the White Army to face off against the Bolsheviks, which Wilson bitterly opposed. Wilson said that that Britain should stick to the countries that it owns, inverted commas, and stay out of the business of other countries. So, I mean, it was far from easy sailing after 1918. You had extra responsibilities for the British Empire, and you also at the same time had the demobbing of men who expected a lot better from their lives, having sacrificed so much in the First World War.
I think it's a real kind of serious business that people misunderstand, don't they? We hit the armistice and everyone thinks that the guns fall silent and it's peace across Europe, and it really, really is not. The fighting comes home in a lot of countries. You mentioned Russia, but there's revolution in Germany and of course, fighting in Ireland as well.
Yeah.
You got lots of men with a strong desensitization to violence and a healthy dose of PTSD come home, don't they?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, the First World War really was it was the end of the First World War, and it should be I think noted that you know, Ireland was part of the United Kingdom during the First World War. My last book was Wherever the Firing Line Extends was about the Irish experience in the Great War, which is really only now being properly excavated, so to speak. So I mean, there was 40,000 men from the island of Ireland killed in the First World War. 30,000 actually from what is now the 26 counties of the Republic of Ireland. So, like, I mean, the Irish have played a full part in the First World War for good or ill, but that's not the end of it. I mean, as soon as the war is over, within a month, there was a declaration of independence by the Irish Parliament. All those who had won seats in the Westminster Parliament election of December 1918, they declare an independent Irish state, set up an independent Irish Parliament on the same day, which is the 21st of January 1919. The Irish War of Independence begins. So you have, for the next 2.5 years, you have a conflict between Britain and Ireland, between the IRA on the one hand and British Crown forces on the other. And of course, Wilson will have a great personal interest in this conflict, given that he's Irish himself, but he's of the Unionist tradition. And I think he brings a particular Irish animus to the whole conflict. He's so emotionally connected to the fight against the IRA that he can't really see beyond that. He can't see that this is some kind of a rogue offensive by a few misguided separatists. This is a popular rebellion against British rule in Ireland. Wilson is inveigled in this, and he becomes a field marshal in June 1919. It's an honorary title, really, because he, as we have spoken about before, he didn't really spend a huge amount of time in the field during the First World War, but it's given to him for his role as you know, for all his service to Britain in the First World War. But it's at that stage that he starts to fall out with the British government over Ireland. He feels that the Irish situation is a security situation, that the British should send in 40,000 men and crush the IRA. The British government is constrained by the fact that there's widespread international sympathy for Ireland, especially in the United States, and a lot of sort of liberal Britain is horrified by the excesses of the Crown forces that are sent to Ireland, the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, which are, as you say, former British servicemen who are sent to Ireland to keep the peace, but actually end up alienating the entire population. So there is a huge standoff between Wilson and the British government in this time period.
I think what you're describing, I'm guessing, is what's referred to as the Orange Terror. Which is, so the Orange side is the Unionist side, isn't it? Yeah. So what is the Orange Terror specifically, and does Wilson play a role in it?
Well, this is where it gets kind of complicated, because while the War of Independence is going on in the south of Ireland in what's now known as the 26 counties, now it is in 32 counties as well, but not to the same extent. There's effectively a civil war going on in the north as well. And it's an embryonic troubles, which has been largely forgotten about. It lasted from July 1922 July 2022, where you have a Unionist backlash against Irish nationalism. It begins with the expulsions from the shipyards of Catholic workers and what's known as rotten prods, left-wing Protestants. And that starts 2 years of bloodshed, which leads to the deaths of over 500 people. It's a sectarian conflict. But the people who suffer most in it are the nationalist stroke Catholic population of the north. They account for twice as many fatalities as Protestants, even though the population is reversed. They're only a third of the population. And there is obviously a backlash. The Northern Ireland state is created in June 1921. There's a backlash by Irish nationalists against that. there are a couple of state forces that are founded at this time, the Ulster Special Constabulary in particular, which known better known as the B Specials, and they are in, meant to be the state forces to keep the peace. But actually, as far as most nationalists in the north are concerned, they are a force that are directly is directly opposed to them. So you have a problem in the north with sectarian violence as well. And into this steps Wilson in March 1920. Now, just to fill you in the picture, he his 4-year terms as the chief of the Imperial General Staff, SIGS as is known, ends in February 1922. Within 3 or 4 days, he's elected as unopposed as a Ulster Unionist MP. For North Down, he sits on the Conservative benches at that stage. Many of the Conservatives are anti the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which had been signed in December the previous year, setting up the Irish Free State. So straight away, Wilson is made the chief military advisor to the Northern government of Sir James Craig, the Northern Ireland Prime Minister. And he becomes associated in the minds, Wilson becomes associated in the minds of Irish nationalists with the excesses of state forces in the north, the B Specials, the RUC and the British Army. And so the principal reason why he was shot, and we're going to come on to his assassination presumably in a few minutes, is because he's associated with the Northern pogroms. He's associated with the pogroms against the nationalist Catholic population in the north. And this is the principal reason why he's assassinated in June 1922.
Yeah, I mean, I'm now sort of thinking back into 1914 and Currer a little bit, and actually his role in stopping the British Army piling in there. Obviously, that would have been against Unionists there too, so I guess he's not opposed to force in some sort of sense, and he clearly picks his side, doesn't he?
Well, yes, on that subject, I mean, he was deeply involved in the Currer mutiny. This was, well, it wasn't a mutiny as such because there was no order, but it was, it's known as the Currer incident, whereby the British government has made contingency plans for, in the event of Home Rule being implemented, that the British Army would keep order in the north. There's quite a few Anglo-Irish officers who are based in the Currer say they're not going to obey British Army orders. Wilson, who is director of military operations at this side, and then therefore, you know, one of the chief senior forces in the army, is intriguing on the side of the of those who won't march against, who won't obey a British government order if it came to it. And to be honest, it made Wilson huge enemies in the British establishment, particularly among Herbert Asquith, the British Prime Minister, who regarded him as an intriguer and a poisonous ruffian, as he called him. And it's not coincidental that Wilson didn't become SIGS until Herbert Asquith had left office in December 1916.
Yeah, because Asquith was nearly ruined in 14. The First World War basically saved his premiership, didn't it? He was gone, I think.
Yeah, and Asquith was the first person to pay tribute to Wilson after he died. But Asquith had no time for Wilson. He regarded him as a gossiper, an intriguer, somebody who was trying to undermine the government. He wasn't far wrong there. But I think that Lloyd George saw in Wilson a sort of a maverick spirit like he had. He regarded Wilson as very much self-made, very mercurial, like Lloyd George. Lloyd George put a huge amount of trust in Wilson. Obviously, you know as well as I do how much Lloyd George despised most of the British generals, particularly Douglas Haig, but he seems to have had a soft spot for Wilson, and that's why he made Wilson SIGS in February 1918.
Kindred spirit, I suppose. Let's introduce a couple more characters then, shall we? Reginald Dunn, who's this?
Reginald Dunn is the son of a British Army bandmaster, and he is... London born. He's born in Woolwich Barracks in 1898. He is a Jesuit educated Catholic boy, deeply devout, who joins the British Army on his 18th birthday in 1916. He joins the Irish Guards, so obviously he's got an Irish background. His mother's family is from County Monaghan, and he is wounded during the German spring offensive of 1918 and invalided out of the army. And then in 1919, he's a musician. As I said, his father was a bandmaster in the British Army. He becomes interested in the Irish question, as they call it at the time, through his involvement with an organization called Conra na Gaeilge, which is an Irish language and music organization, which had a lot of branches in London. He's completely radicalized. He joins the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, and also the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which is a secret organization. He becomes, with the zeal of the convert, he becomes a completely messianic supporter of Irish independence. He becomes the officer commanding the London IRA. And we now know, thanks to files that have only been released in recent years, just how important the London IRA was in terms of the supplying guns to the IRA in Ireland, and also in involving themselves in sort of a guerrilla campaign of burnings and arson attacks that really unsettled the population in London. And he was also involved, I think it's important to state, in plans to assassinate the British cabinet, which were first activated in 1918, but only acted upon when they shot Wilson in 1922. So he's a very intriguing character. He's an intellectual. He's a Catholic. He's a devout Catholic. He's a deep thinker. He wins prizes for poetry in school, and he becomes a trainee teacher after the war. He also is in receipt of an invalid pension from the British government, and he's not really anybody's idea of who you would think would be a radical Irish nationalist.
We also have, as well, don't we, Joseph O'Sullivan.
Joe O'Sullivan's from a more conventional Irish background, whereas Reggie Dunn was an only child. Joe O'Sullivan was from a more stereotypical large Irish Catholic family. There was 11 surviving children. His father was from Bantry County, West Cork, which is sort of the heartland of Irish, the Irish Fenian movement. But Joe O'Sullivan, he has 7 brothers. 6 of them served in the First World War. Joe O'Sullivan joins the London Regiment in 1915. It's interesting that he joins voluntarily as well. He's not conscripted, and he loses his leg at Passchendaele in August 1917. He is invalided out. Obviously, he gets a job as a messenger in the Department of the Ministry of Labour after the war. And he's familiar with what Henry Wilson looks like, because Henry Wilson is dropping into the Ministry of Labour on business related to the demobbing of former soldiers. Joe Sullivan too joins the IRA in 1919, as does his brother Pat O'Sullivan, who's left a very long and interesting testimony about the family's involvement in the IRA. He was from a family of master tailors. Pat O'Sullivan writes about in his letter for an Irish pension how he had used his tailor shop in Chancery Lane as a place to store guns for the IRA. He also, himself and Joe O'Sullivan and Reggie Dunn, used their wound badges that they receive as First World War veterans to walk into British Army barracks and steal rifles and ammunition for the IRA. So they're two very intriguing characters. Again, very well educated by the standards of the time. They're both actually public schoolboys, so to speak. Reggie Dunn goes to St. Ignatius College in London, and he is, believe it or not, a contemporary of Alfred Hitchcock, whereas Joe Sullivan goes to St. Edmunds Ware's College, which I think is in Hertfordshire. Cambridgeshire, which is the oldest continuous Catholic school in Britain.
Interesting. The point you make about knowing what Wilson looks like, I think he had a fairly distinctive appearance, didn't he? And he had a face that even a mother would struggle to love.
I struggled with that myself, but I think we have got to look back to the time before TV, before the internet, before radio. I mean, just knowing what people looked like is not that easy. I mean, Michael Collins managed to avoid British intelligence for a long time because they had no photograph of him. So you might think, well, we know what Wilson looks like now, but it wasn't that easy back then. To there was a lot of mustachioed sort of ex-British generals walking around the streets in London. And also another important thing was that they also knew his address, which is number 36 Eaton Place, and I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, it's bonkers, isn't it, when you think about it like that? It's just like, how do you even know that you've got the right guy as well? Because even like, yeah, you might have seen a portrait in a newspaper, yeah, but those portraits often don't actually look. I mean, they're supposed to give the best side. They're not like candid selfies, are they, Lockie?
No, I think, yeah, some of those portraits even make Wilson look, you know, really, really handsome. Dashing.
Yeah. they managed to find some side of him that isn't quite as bad, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they had to. There's an interesting story in my book about this guy called Cathal Brua, who was the first significant fatality of the Irish Civil War. But he was going around. They had built up a list of targets that they were going to attack, including all the members of the British cabinet and people like Lord Rothermere, who was the proprietor of the Daily Mail, etc. And he had them like football cards. I mean, he was looking, this is what these guys look like. And you think, well, actually, you know, how would you know what these people look like unless you had photographs of them? And how do you go about? You can't just buy a newspaper and hope they'll be there. You know, you have to cut out the photographs, etc. So it wasn't as easy as people think to target these people in those days.
Okay, I mean, well, they've got his address. Then they've got reason. You know, having looked at the kind of politics behind it, we've got a bit of context here. Is there any more to the assassination to bear in mind?
Well, the thing about it is that obviously when you want to assassinate somebody, you have to have a motive and you have to have an opportunity, right? So the motive that I explained to you before was Wilson's perceived a role in the Orange Terror, as I described it. But what about the opportunity? So there's a meeting of the IRA. They are divided over the treaty, whether to support the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which sets up the Irish Free State. The meeting's held in June the 21st, in Mooney's Pub in Holborn, which I believe is still there. And in walks a guy, one of the officers with a photograph, with a copy of the evening news. And there in buried probably on page 7 is a single paragraph, a news and brief, as we call in journalism, stating that Henry Wilson is going to unveil a memorial at Liverpool Street Station the following day. And suddenly here we know where Wilson is going to be. And so Reggie Dunn and Joe O'Sullivan, they look at this and they're thunderstruck, right? And they decide to repair to Liverpool Street Station to check out the joint. They realise that they're not going to be able to kill this guy at Liverpool Street. They're not going to be able to get away. So they wait for Wilson to unveil the memorial and they walk to his house. So he unveils the memorial about 1:45. Wilson has a meeting in the House of Commons at around 3:30, so he's got to go home and change back into civilian clothes. And they're waiting for him on the doorstep of his home at 36 Eaton Place, and they shoot him 6 times and they kill him. So, and then you might ask the question, why on earth would you have a one-legged man as one of the assassins? Well, as I said to you, the opportunity, you had to take the opportunity when it came. And this was the only opportunity they have. You know, in those days, you didn't know where a politician was going to be from one day to the next. So Joe Sullivan was available and he was willing to do it. So they shot him. But, you know, Reggie Dunn is also a wounded veteran. They try to get away. They shoot 2 policemen as they're trying to flee the mob that's chasing after them. But of course, eventually they run out of ammunition and run out of puff. So they are caught at Ebury Street, which is about 600 or 700 meters away. They're attacked by a mob. They're saved by the police, but the police take them to Gerrard Street Police Station and beat the hell out of them. And then they appear in court that evening. And of course, like it's a slam dunk, really. I mean, you know, there's no way they're going to get away with this, so they're sentenced to be executed.
Let's leave them, because I'm conscious of, I want people to go and buy the book. So if you want to find out the full story of what happened to Dunn and O'Sullivan, go buy the book. But I do want to talk about the knock-on effect of Wilson's murder. So first of all, how does the world react?
Absolute shock and consternation. You know, we've had, I'm speaking to you today as the as we talk about the former Japanese Prime Minister has just been assassinated, and you can imagine that the world reaction to that. And this is a huge shock in the UK. I mean, we're not talking about a backbench MP. We're talking about the former head of the British Army. We're talking about somebody who is one of the men who wins the war, as far as many of his contemporaries are concerned. We're talking about somebody who was part of the delegation that negotiated the Treaty of Versailles. And we're talking about the first assassination on British soil since 1812, since the Prime Minister in 1812. And I go into this in detail in the book, how, you know, lots of countries in Europe, and of course, the United States loses three presidents to assassination in the 19th and early 20th century. It's just not the British way of doing things. A political assassination is not the British way. And so there's massive shock and consternation in Britain. Also, there's a belief that here we are, you know, I thought we had solved the Irish question, you know, by setting up the Free State. There was supposed to be peace between Britain and Ireland. And here, you know, the head of the British Army, the former head of the British Army, has been assassinated on the streets. It makes worldwide headlines. It's the front page in practically every American newspaper the following day. There's consternation in France as well. I mean, the British Army is known in France as l'Armée de Wilson, the Wilson Army, and so on. And so all the Allies are really, really shocked by this. And it should be noted as well that 2 days after Wilson is assassinated, the German Foreign Minister Walter Rathenau was also assassinated. So the world is really reeling from the shock of all of this. And if you look at the video footage, and it's, you can Google it, or you can go to YouTube and see it, of Wilson's funeral. I mean, it's one of the biggest funerals that London has ever had outside a member of the British royal family.
What about in Ireland? I mean, if there's consternation in the UK, is the reaction similar in Ireland? Is there a sense of, oh God, what's happened now?
There is, really. I mean, there's a shock in Ireland about it too. Arthur Griffith, who's the president of Dáil Éireann, effectively the leader of the state, says this isn't the way we do business. I mean, you know, I don't think I'd be letting you into any secret to say that the vast majority of people in nationalist Ireland, at least, had no time for Wilson and his views. But, you know, that's one aspect of it. But to be assassinated the way he was on the streets of London was a shock for the Irish government. Of course, it created a huge problem, which for the Irish government as well, because and precipitated the Civil War. In the north, he's regarded as the first martyr of the northern state by James Craig, the Prime Minister. And it is interesting, actually, bringing it up to the present day, that on the centenary of his assassination, there was a plaque unveiled in the House of Commons chamber. I happened to be there at the time, by the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, and done by Jacob Rees-Mogg. And the principal people behind that plaque were Ulster Unionist MPs, including most particularly Ian Paisley. So he's still regarded in some ways as a martyr of the for Northern Ireland, whereas in the South he was regarded as basically what he was, an enemy of Irish nationalism.
I think as well, you use a particular phrase. Why do you refer to his assassination as Ireland's Sarajevo?
Well, I think this is why this assassination is such a significant event in Irish history. So going back to the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty in December 1921, which sets up the Irish Free State, there's the Irish nationalist movement, the Sinn Féin and the IRA at the time split over this. There are those who are willing to accept the treaty as a stepping stone for freedom, as Michael Collins says, and there's those like Eamon de Valera who are opposed to it. They say that they want an Irish 32 county Irish republic rather than Dominion status that still has the king as the head of state. And this is a very, very serious impasse. And in the IRA, which had been the which had fought the British to a standstill in July 1921, a split over this. Substantial portion of the senior commanders in the IRA refused to accept the new Irish government, refused to accept the treaty. They occupied the forecourts, which is like the Old Bailey of Ireland in April 1922. And they're still in situ in by the time Wilson is assassinated in June 1922. To cut a long story short, the British government, whether conveniently or not, blame the anti-treaty side for the shooting of Wilson. They tell the provisional Irish government at that stage, headed by Michael Collins, that if the provisional government doesn't deal with the anti-treaty rebels and get them out of the forecourts, that the British government will come back into Ireland and do it for them. Bear in mind that there's still a British garrison in Ireland of about 7,000 soldiers. And the British cabinet is spoiling for a fight following the assassination of Wilson. Winston Churchill, who's the Secretary of State for the colonies, wants to send in the Royal Navy and the RAF. So there's a danger here that we're going to reignite the war between Britain and Ireland. So the Irish government is left in a difficult situation. Either it deals with the Forecourt rebels and risks the possibility of a civil war, or it doesn't deal with them and risks starting a war with Britain, which it can't really win because you just don't have the IRA has been degraded since the War of Independence ended. So it's a terrible dilemma for the Irish government, and they take the path of least resistance and decide to deal with the Forecourt rebels. And this, the shelling of the Forecourts on June the 28th, 1922, is the event that starts the Civil War. So getting back to the question about Ireland, Sarajevo, we know that the First World War begins with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand in June 1914. This precipitates an ultimatum from the Serbian from the Austrian government to Serbia. So if you substitute the British ultimatum to the Irish government, Serbia can't agree with this ultimatum. So basically, what I suggest in my book is that without the Wilson shooting, there would have been no Irish Civil War, and the history of Ireland would have been different.
This whole period is absolutely fascinating, and I love the historical parallels. I mean, this one with Sarajevo is something. I think the violence reaching the streets in Ireland is comparable with German Revolution as well. The use of political murder as a tool is just, it's something that we, as you say, it's kind of, we should come back to us today with the Japanese former prime minister as well.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've ever spoken to him, but there's a book by a German historian who's based here in Dublin by Robert Gerwarth called Why the First World War Failed to End. And it's a brilliant resume of all the civil wars that occurred after the First World War. He estimates that in the 4 years after the First World War, 4 million people died in Europe from various different civil wars and conflicts, and that includes Ireland.
It's a cracking book, actually.
He's an excellent author. I've got a few of his on the shelves. They are very good indeed.
Yeah.
And it's just so much to consider as well. I mean, 1922, politically, things spiral in the UK as well, and you have the big general election where Lloyd George is turfed out as well. Maybe that's kind of a lead into what happens, but we're in danger of digressing here. And
well, I think it's important. I mean, now that you mention it, Alex, I mean, obviously you have all this intrigue in the UK at the moment. There was somebody on Newsnight was making the analogy between Lloyd George and Johnson. I mean, Lloyd George was, as we know, a brilliant man in a lot of ways, self-made, but also economical with the actuality, as you say. And he was brought down by several scandals, wasn't he? And of course, when we talk about the 1922 committee, what are we referring to? Well, we're referring to the Carlton House mutiny against the coalition government at the time. So it's really interesting, I think, how history is repeating itself again, 100 years on, not just in Ireland, but in the UK as well.
And what's interesting is that George V tells Lloyd George, you can have this election right now in the aftermath of the war and you will win, but then you will get turfed out and you will never see power again. He actually predicts it, and Lloyd George just laughs at him like, oh, silly little man with silly little beard, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, no, but he's bang on.
Yeah, I just think if you think things are unraveling at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that, yeah, I mean, I, whether you agree with Boris Johnson or not, he is a historically consequential British Prime Minister, as was Lloyd George. I mean, but I see huge analogies between Lloyd George and Boris Johnson, although I think that Lloyd George was much the more substantial politician. But nevertheless, I mean, what you're seeing in Britain at the moment has its parallels 100 years ago, you know, and the Wilson shooting didn't help the Move music either. I mean, there was talk at that time that it was going to bring down the British government, but it certainly concentrated the minds of a lot of diehards in the Conservative Party who didn't really want the settlement with Ireland. And it's one of the reasons why I think that the Conservatives left government, not the only one or the principal reason, but it didn't help the Mead music when the Conservatives left the coalition government in October 1922. So, very interesting. Very interesting time and very interesting parallels with the present day, I think.
Right. Well, I've loved this. I think it's been really, really interesting. Ronan, it's been excellent having you on. Just run us through the name of your book and where people can find out more, please.
Yes, it's my book is called Great Hatred, The Assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, MP. It's published by Faber and Faber in hardback and paperback, and it should be available in all good bookshops and on Amazon and wherever else you can buy your books. It should be available.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much once again. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Thank you, Andrew. And it's been fascinating speaking to you guys, and I really appreciate the time you've taken to speak to me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.